battery are the same. It's just they put a little bit more effort into, less contamination, better uniformity and other factors. And one of the big problems, as I see it, of lead acid, which I don't think is that much of a problem, perhaps, in car drop over the time period. Every so often, in the old days, I would hear people complain that weird things happen to their radio, and usually when they take out the voltmeter, they see that what's happening is, rather than getting a 12.8 or a 13 volt supply, you're getting 6. Because the battery is on its last lives, and it's discharged to the point where its voltage output is far below the original full charge level. So I don't believe that that's the case with lithium iron phosphate. They maintain a rather steady voltage until towards the very end of their charge cycle.
I agree. Another thing I like with them, they have these additional wing nuts on top, so it was real easy to hook up a mobile radio to it. You could instead of splicing it in or getting involved with different kinds of connectors on your existing battery. I mean, you just open up the wing, connect anything. You just the batteries were tied in. One part of it, but you have these wing nuts that you can open up and put big heavy connectors in there, or whatever you wanted to do to tie in a radio. It was an old truck. I mean, easy enough to go through the firewall with wiring and everything. So it was really fun. Back to you, Roy.
Connectors on all batteries of that nature had to be, built really big, because a lot of current could run through them, and you don't want it to heat up and burn out or anything. So, the usual for the automobile is those big... wing nuts. Lower capacity, lower current rechargeables have these little tabs, these copper tabs. They're not usually, they're maybe designed for maybe motorcycles, but anything more powerful, you need something with a lot more current carrying capacity.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
First of all, I'm on my vertical now, if it makes any difference at all. That's number one. But my question is, on battery terminals, the stuff that builds up on the terminal, is that dry acid, number one, and why does it build up on the terminals? Go ahead.
I would imagine that what's happening is the sulfonation that's taking place on the electrodes is kind of creeping up and out of the shell into that lead. So I could be entirely wrong. It could be just simple corrosion and electrolysis and all kinds of fun other things going on. But that would be my guess. I never actually scraped any of that stuff off and put it through a mass spec to find out whether there's much in the way of sulfur compounds. Because if you found sulfur in it, that would be the giveaway that it was the sulfuric acid interacting with the cathodes and such.
10-1, Whitey White.
Okay, and I guess that eventually interferes with the capacity of the battery, because they're always saying to keep those terminals clean, and I wonder how many of us actually do that. I had trouble with the battery I bought at Walmart, God forbid, and after 2 years, the thing rated at only 66%, And I had trouble with it towards the last part of the winter where it got really cold. And if I left the car for 2 days in a row without driving it, I'd have to charge it again. So, but now with the warmer weather, that and other problems with the car have gone away, believe it or not. So, okay. Is there any change in my signal, by the way, between the rubber duck and the vertical that's outside? Go ahead.
And comment on the battery terminals, too, when you get a chance, Roy.
I think it's the contact that's kind of giving you those characteristics, although it's always a good idea every so often to clean out the schmutz that's developing on the contact. You want a nice low-resistance connection. What happens with lead-acid cells is that the cathode and the anode elements get coated with a similar gunky sulfonic compound that crystallizes and that does not reverse when you charge it. So little by little, surface area of your electrodes are being taken over by some insulating non-electrical power generating chemical crystals. And little by little, it degrades the amount of charge that each cell can take until, you know, it fails earlier and earlier and earlier. So it's probably the sulfonation that does it. In the good old days, when Dick ran this, this almost always led to a conversation from the IRLP-linked Canadian listeners, because for some odd reason they seem to have more experience, and there was conversations that there is equipment. If you Google sulfonation lead acid cells, there are a lot of chargers that cycle at high frequencies and promise to break up the sulfonation. But some of them may temporarily work. It's not a permanent fix from what I understand, but, you know, some people swore by these little gizmos that, of course, cost a lot more to charge up your battery than a generic charger, but they promoted the fact that they broke down the sulfonation of the electrodes. So that's probably why most lead acids fail these days. In the old days, when they weren't failed, a lot of times it was simply because people let the water run out. There was an escape a valve, and you had to check the water, the density of the water, and add distilled water over time. But with failed batteries, that is no longer necessary.
Comments in 1YDY?
Yes, hi.
Yeah, the sulfonation, as you call it, the lead sulfate, DBSO4, that goes through both anodes, terminals, will in fact, because of the lack of the sulfate to cheat that goes on the positive terminal, will move up the negative terminal and present itself as corrosion on the top, and that's what the gentleman was talking about cleaning off, and that's actually an indicator of the state of discharge, the battery not being fully charged at the time the car was turned off. Also, you keep talking about the sulfation on the terminals of the anodes, and the thing is that sulfation on the lead will crystallize. Once it crystallizes, it becomes hard and very difficult even for those high-frequency devices to help it go back into solution when you put a charge of current. And so you're correct with what you're describing, but it's those high-frequency pulse chargers that these guys are talking about, that's incorporated into almost any charger that you buy today, because most of them are switching type chargers, so it's not a unique thing. It's just something that was very popular in certain locations before it became cheap enough to be the standard. I think that's about all I want to add.
Thank Okay, Hank, thank you. I was unaware that it has become a generic addition to the design, although it makes sense. The switching power supplies are incredibly common and probably doesn't cost too much to engineer any kind of specific cycle time. I don't know because I haven't looked, but it's not anything that particularly interests me. But I'm sure there are companies that are promoting their chargers purely for this miracle cure for once upon a time dead lead acid cells. So they're still trying to squeeze a couple of bucks out of people, most likely, in my surmise. But I'm glad to hear that they've incorporated it in all the chargers. Kind of made it a afterthought. Thanks for adding that, Hank.
WS2N.
One second, Paul. Just the other thing was is that when a battery goes back into normal and benefits from having the propane go back into solution during the charge, it does help, but it doesn't do anything for the crystallized sulfate. That remains implacable, for lack of a better phrase. It simply doesn't break down and go back into the solution, which is why the specific gravity of the electrolyte in the battery also changes over time.
Oh, that's interesting, but as far as I'm aware, most batteries these days are sealed, so you can't really assess that anymore, or am I mistaken?
No, not every battery is sealed. You can still buy non-sealed batteries, and they still have very similar internal chemistry, although the strengthening alloy, you know, pure lead is very weak, and it's not vibration resistant. So they use either calcium or antimony, depending upon whether it's a semi-sealed design, the ones that you can't open and they simply have an overpressure relief valve, or the, and they call them maintenance trees, but they're still lead acid batteries, or the conventional ones where you can still top the tops and top off with distilled water, which tend to live longer. They have a, you know, if you keep them topped off and they have a longer duty life, cycle life. They have a greater number of cycles, charge and discharge cycles, start cycles. Anyway, I'm sorry, Paul, I didn't mean to cut you off. I don't know why you like that.
Yes, Paul, you were going to say something?
Okay, and good evening, Hank. Yeah, the battery corrosion problem. I use a spray that you spray onto the battery terminal, and it really helps a lot. It's a battery terminal protection spray. You can get it in AutoZone, you know, or probably even Walmart. It's made by Lynx, LYNX, really, you know, which is really made by East Penn. East Penn is really involved with, you know, lead-acid batteries. And this stuff is just great. I mean, it's the air, keeps the air away from the terminals, which really, really helps. You spray it on, it's like a light, like a light reddish color. You know, it's not like a paint. So in other words, if let's say you still want to jump somebody, you can still put cables on it and jump somebody with no problem. Whatever this stuff is, it allows slow and resistance. So it's really good. I mean, you know, anytime you change your batteries, you'll see some metal still there. You just spray the stuff on it, and it really, really helps in any kind of corrosion problem. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, we've gotten a lot out of lead acid technology. It was, I believe, the first real rechargeable battery technology all the way back, made commercial in the 1800s. We're still using some variation of it, so it's incredible that, you know, some technology has a lifespan. We're kind of used to disposable technologies where one week it's nickel cadmium, the next week it's metal hydride, and the following week it's lithium ion. So, you know, nice to know you can depend upon something. But thanks for that information as well.
And voice.
Okay. Any comments on this or any of the earlier subjects, please hit that push-to-talk button.
Voice of station. I heard another station, but it wasn't me, Roy, so it's somebody else. He's a little noisy.
That Connecticut station that's trying to talk to a completely different repeater. So we'll turn to Mike. What did you want to say, Mike?
Just wanted to see if Tony W2ASC, I know he's a Hoda Jedi Master. I'm just curious on this topic of battery. How long of a battery runtime does he need? An hour, 2 hours? Just so you can sort of understand how much battery I would need.
Okay, Tony, what do you have to say?
Well, I don't do QRP. I use a radio that, you know, is capable of doing 100 watts. I don't even run 100 watts. The battery that I use is 20 amp hour, and I've run for 4 or 5 hours pretty close to 100 watts and haven't gotten any proof of discharge. So that's really more than enough. And I know my probably with QRP to get away with a much more light battery, but even a 20 amp hour battery is very light. Any of the
okay, does that answer your question, Mike?
Yes, thank you, Roy. Thank you, Tony.
Call me if you have any further questions. Not a problem.
KDU-DDW, I'll be standing by. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, very good. I mean, ultimately, you know, as Tony mentioned, the incredibly important thing, in addition to how many hours you plan to operate, is how much power you're planning to use and how efficient your transmitter is. You know, that's the basis for coming to some conclusion of how much capacity you want the battery to be. Anyone else with any comments on either this topic or any of the previous topics, please hit that push the talk button.
Well, I just want to quickly ask you, this is WTBZ. Do you still hear that raindrop effect now that I'm on a different antenna? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's very, very, very slight in the background.
Well, I can't imagine what it is. I switched to my vertical antenna. It must be being internally generated by the radio, huh?
Yeah, it's either that, or there might be some kind of a fan or mechanical device in the background that you've kind of blanked out of your mind because it's kind of a background sound. So I'm not quite sure what it is. It's very, very subtle. I mean, you shouldn't be concerned about it. No one's going to complain about it. It's just a sound characteristic of your transmission, after all.
Okay, so basically the signals are the same with the rubber duck and the vertical.
Yes, indeed. I probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
That's amazing. All right, thank you. Back to Nick.
Like I always say, don't question success. If for whatever reason, propagation, line of sight, and whatever you can imagine is decent enough to full quieting the repeater, then, you know, quadrupling the signal and raising it up higher isn't going to effectively change it for the sake of the repeater. That's why it slightly annoys me on a technical aspect when people start to give S numbers to their repeater signal, because it's not them, it's the repeater that has that strength. People have to kind of get used to the concept that when they're talking about their interaction with the repeater, the principal thing to look at is not the signal strength, but just the degree of quieting of their signal, which sometimes people just figure out quickly, but others it takes a little bit longer. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limewatch Technical Net. And if anyone has any other questions of a technical nature, now's as good a time as any. Just hit that push talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Say again, I think I got TEB, W2TEB.
W2 Tango Echo Solid Radio Service.
It was TEB, please.
One more time, W2TEC. I assume you have a comment about something, or a question, or something. So, what might it be?
Yeah, this is W2TEC. Name here is Chris. I like to use breaking open laptop batteries that are not usable anymore. I usually find like one or two cells that are dead inside, and the rest of them I salvage and I make up my own battery pack. So I use it in my class light. Those are 18650. I don't know if anybody does them.
Well, some people do. Not all laptop batteries are packed up as multiple 18650s. Some companies manufacture their own proprietary lithium polymer so that they can get the most storage capacity for the space that they have available. But I have seen it. The only problem that I would be concerned about is a lot of those batteries do not have built-in tabs, and it's very difficult to solder them. Usually they are spot welded with tin. So is it just that when you've broken them up they still have tabs on them, or do you spot weld them together?
No, what I usually do is leave the tab a little bit long, cut it, and fold it over to make my own little contact. So I don't have to spot weld and I don't have to solder. And they usually fit right into anything you want to use. But if you make a battery pack for an HP, for instance, you have to probably just leave the tabs long and solder them together. And then hopefully it fits into the pack that you have. If that happens, then it works well, and I'll just use sometimes an RC car charger to charge up a 7.4 volt pack, or even I'll use a bent power supply.
Hello. Okay, that certainly is a solution. I have had devices that have no separate tab. They're kind of spot welded into the device. So if you remove the old battery and replace it with another one, you're stuck with the same problem of either spot welding it or attempting unsuccessfully to solder it. So your batteries, thankfully, already have tabs built into them. So that's a good way of recycling equipment. I don't have that many lithium iron batteries that are made out of discrete. I mean, my laptops are 10. I think most of them are form-factored lithium iron ion polymer because they're just too thin to be a 18650. But so that's a great idea.
I even use old cell phone batteries, the flat ones, and I usually either parallel or series them together, and I use it for all types of things. And the 18650s, you can actually adapt them to put into a D-cell, a 2D-cell or a 3D-cell flashlight, and they work really well. All you need is like a 3/4 inch PVC pipe and a couple of shims to make it the right diameter, and a plug that would be to make up the distance of the battery, and they work great. They last a long time.
Very good. You probably right into QSC's hints and kinks. I remember, they had similar manufactured holders where if you only had, say, a AA or even a AAA, it would fit into a holder and be able to then fit into a piece of equipment that took a C or a D so that you could use it. It wouldn't have anything close to the capacity of the original C and D, but it was usable in case of emergency, but again, that's another clever idea, and you have to be a little bit careful about the increased voltage of an 18650 versus a D cell. Some flashlights will take it without a problem, but others might blow out.
Yeah, this is W2DC. Yeah, what I usually do is to lower the voltage, I'll put one or two diodes in. That would drop it, 0.6 or diode or 0.5. Cut some of the voltage that way. And I've never had a problem. If you have a 3D cell flashlight, you can put it in no problem because the battery's the bulb is rated for like 4.5 volts. So you shouldn't have any problems with just one 18650. You don't need two batteries, you only need one.
Yeah, that's true. It depends upon the design of the device, but putting in a diode to have a voltage drop is a good idea. There are other ways. You could just use a Zener diode. You could use a voltage regulator. It depends on how fancy, but quick and simple would be just a diode that introduces, if it's silicon, that's 0.6 volts of voltage drop right there. So. Great ideas. Again, you should consider writing something up and sending it to QSC.
I don't think I'm that intelligent. I'm just playing around. I'm like the end user. I do whatever I want with my own equipment. Just have fun putzing around in the basement. That's about it.
Okay, but I mean, that's as much of a hobby as anything else. I mean, QSC is not quite the place where electrical engineers go to discuss esoterica. They have a quarterly called QEX where you can get a nosebleed following the mathematics. But if you've ever read an issue of QSC, there's a column called Hints and Kinks. It's been around, God knows, probably 50 years. And this is pretty much the type of stuff that's in Hints and Kinks. Some guy will tell people how he took an old desk lamp from Staples and jury-rigged it into a boom for his overhead microphone and such. So, again, I don't know if you've read QSC, but, again, that's the type of stuff that they go for. So I think it would be a good match.
Actually, I do have a few of their the books that they all sell. I have a few of those. But, I've read a lot of their articles, and but I've been touching around like this since I was a kid. But usually when I was a kid, I didn't have a lot of money, so you had to be very creative. You had to figure out what you could do, because I can't go to the store and buy it if you don't have any money. But now I'm pretty well off. I don't have to worry about that. But it's still in my blood to do. Okay, this is W2TV. I'm just going to listen on.
I mean, we're all a bit of tinkerers. When I was a kid, I could only cajole my family into getting a regular AM, FM, shortwave, portable radio. And I wanted to listen to amateur radio operators. Most of them, you know, the late 60s were already, they've moved on to single sideband. So I jury-rigged this thing with another cheap transistor radio. I used its local oscillator for its IF as a local oscillator, like it would work for a single sideband demodulator. I injected a carrier into it, and the detector did the rest of the work, and I was able to hear guys on single sideband using an AM radio. So, poverty is the mother of invention. So I think a lot of us have that type of roots. But I thank you, Chris, for your participation tonight. Anyone else with any comments on any of the subjects that we covered before, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Again, there's someone out there whose noise, I don't know if they're local and just too far away, or the power is not that strong, or if that's the gentleman in Connecticut trying to have a conversation on another repeater and just banging into ours. So if you're local, if you can up the gain, if you can move your antenna around to a slightly better position, if you're indoors, go to a window, if you can go outside, if the hill around, that's a good idea. If there's a high point in your property, that's another idea. So give it another try.
And white 17.
Yes. Could you give me your call sign one more time?
NY 17, November Yankee 7, Papa.
Okay, very good. NY 17. Do you have any comments or questions or statements?
Okay, just what was the name of the spray material? I think it was Link. Just want to confirm.
Are you alluding to what Paul mentioned about the corrosion material on the battery post?
Affirmative.
Paul, can you say it again?
Okay, that was Link. L-Y-N-X. L-Y-N-X. I'll double check it. I'll go back and look at that can to verify that. But yeah, you get it from AutoZone. It's a small can, spray can. So sometimes you shake it, it's just like you're spraying paint, but it's not. So yeah, it's very, very good. Car mechanic told me about it many years ago, and I've been using it ever since. If I change out a battery, I'll use it. And I'll even spray connectors on, like PL259 connectors and stuff. I'll spray that just to keep the damage out a little bit. Just don't hurt anything. Back to you.
Thanks so much, guys. Midpoint 17, clear. Thanks, appreciate it.
Well, it's made by East 10, you know, Big Battery.
Yeah, this is a Limark technical net, so if anyone has any other questions or comments of a technical nature, please hit that push talk button, give me your first name and call sign. WA2DPH. Yes, John. Yeah, I have a question, a little more esoteric question, about long delay echoes. I heard a theory quite a number of years ago that long delay echoes are caused by a mode of propagation in the ionosphere, which uses a cyclotron wave, which propagates very slowly and then is converted back to RF. Have you ever heard anything like that? No, I haven't. That's sort of fascinating. What kind of a cyclotron wave were they describing it as? I first heard this when I was at CCNY with a physics teacher I had, who was also a ham radio operator. And it was when there was an article in QST magazine. It came out in the late 60s, early 70s, I think it was the late 60s, about long delay echoes. And I remember in passing, you mentioned about this type of propagation with cyclotron waves, which I don't know what they are, but he mentioned that they have a very slow mode of propagation compared to electromagnetic waves, and he was saying that was one of the modes causing these long delay echoes. I don't know anything else about it. I just wondering if you ever heard about it.
Does exist, apparently. There is even, you know, there's an article on everything. In Wikipedia, it says, in plasma physics, an electrostatic ion cyclotron wave is a longitudinal oscillation of the ions in a magnetized plasma propagating nearly perpendicular to the magnetic field. So instead of it being apparently the flow of charged electrons, it can also be the flow of charged ions, which would significantly probably slow things down. So that's a fascinating possibility, and I really haven't thought about the propagation of ions instead of electrons also taking place, but that would certainly introduce a delay.
Yeah, I always heard people talk about long delay echoes in terms of being reflected off of something, and anything that was far enough away to cause that amount of delay, you're getting very little signal back from it. So I just remember hearing about that, and I saw something that would have been good to hear about it. Anyway, I was just curious.
Yes, Paul.
Looking this up on the internet, it looks like it's going under the name Delta, D-E-K-A. Exactly the same stuff, though. This one's on Amazon, you know, for $11.79. You can buy 10-ounce cans. So it's the same stuff. Comes out reddish, you know. But it's going under a slightly different name than the can I have. Mine's quite a few years old. So it's, yeah, like it's DECA, D-E-K-A, East 10, battery terminal protection for a 10-ounce can. You know, I guess you could probably get it in an auto store, but definitely online. But nowadays, I don't know, everything seems to be online. It's ridiculous. Back to you, Earth.
Thank you.
wanted to make a comment about the cyclotron wave rather than the corrosion removing material.
Can you hear me, John?
Yes, you had a heck of a flashback there calling me, John, but yes, I hear you, Wesley.
Yes, Roy, old times, old good times. I miss him very much. He's interesting quote. In plasma physics, waves in plasmas are interconnected set of particles and fields which propagate in the periodically repeated pattern. So he first established that there is a longitudinal movement. It has nothing to do with quantum physics, but it does involve the ion. But then we're talking about periodic repeating pattern, that would be the echo that we're talking about. But then we have some discontinuity because it is happening in plasma. So how come then whatever we hear in the receiver on the air could affect that what is happening in plasma, in ionosphere? Dr. Roy.
Or comment on that? Well, I'm not quite sure who the last person I heard in my headphones. I would assume that if your transmissions that start off as RF can be somehow interact with the ion to produce this cyclotron wave, there are phenomena that allow the cyclotron wave after a while to degrade back into regular RF that you pick up. But the gentleman who I could not get a call sign, but there was another person in this on the repeater, so please ID.
This is
WHMPH for the comment.
Yes, John. Yeah, and the other part of that that I remember saying was that there was some mode that converted electromagnetic energy into this cyclotron wave, and then it converted it back. So there was some kind of back and forth conversion between the electromagnetic mode and this kind of plasma wave of whatever it is, and that accounted for the long delay echo. So anyway, I was just wondering if anybody else heard about that.
Yes. Roy, if you look at this Wikipedia article, you have right below, you have a series of waves in plasmas, ion acoustic waves, upper hybrid oscillation, low hybrid oscillation. That is discontinued. That means the idea of waves in plasma to be reconverted to electromagnetic waves that bounce back to the receiver sounds unreal for me. What is your opinion?
Taking a look at it as well. Wesley, you wanted to make any other points on this particular subject?
Yeah, I think I was doubling with you. I'm sorry. What I'm saying is, when you look at a Wikipedia article right below, you see also. And then it's waves in plasma, ion acoustic wave, upper hybrid oscillation. And then we're talking about waves in plasma, and we related to that what is happening in ionosphere. There is no reconversion back. So what I'm saying is we cannot apply the concept of cyclotron waves into the phenomena in question and to achieve.
Okay, Wikipedia doesn't really have that much on electrostatic ion cyclotron waves, so I'm going to have to dig a little bit deeper than that. I don't know. I tend to think that generally things that convert into, there's usually an inherent symmetry into a lot of aspects of physics. So if something can transfer from electromagnetic waves to cyclotron ion waves, I don't have that much trouble. The exact opposite effect is possible as well. But like I said, I have a bunch of things apparently to read this week, which is a good thing. Not that I don't have a couple of hundred books to read as well, magazines and all kinds of fun stuff, but those are more the barriers.
Yeah. Go right below that what you see on Wikipedia and go to Waves in Plasma. And it says, in plasma physics, waves in plasmas are an interconnected set of particles and fields which propagate in periodically repeating fashion. A plasma is talking about phenomena that are taking place in fluids or in plasmas and have nothing to do with electromagnetic waves. So I don't know how. And then if you click on that wave in plasmas, it opens up another chapter which explains everything about those the cyclotron waves. I don't see any connection with entropy.
Well, you might be right. I don't know. This is a novel hopefully not a dead end. So again, even that sub article is only something like four paragraphs long. I'm sure there are physics textbooks that take up a couple of chapters on the subject. So I'll have to take a deeper dive into it. It may be a dead end, and the cyclotronic wave, I'll go back into its original source. So, you know, like I said, I'll look it up. There's more to life than Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a wonderful initial way of kind of getting a sense of a subject, but very often I find I have to go elsewhere to kind of plumb the depth. It's sort of depending upon one guy, even though it's supposed to be group written, it ultimately is one usually intelligent guy, sometimes less intelligent people write articles on Wikipedia that survive. So you always need a well-calibrated BS meter. I carry it with me at all times.
I think that there is not much more to it. It is motion of electrons and ions in fluids, and in they talk about Boltzmann relation and lower hybrid oscillation. Lower hybrid oscillation is present in electromagnetism as the frequencies of light and over. So I wouldn't attach that to this object in question. Anyhow, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Wesley. I assume we've kind of moved over into non-specific science and stuff. If Rich is still with us, I believe he had a question that he thought was not quite appropriate for the amateur radio segment. So, Rich, if you got your question, probably now's a good time for it.
Okay, Whiskey King, Robert Lewis. Well, it may not be appropriate for any discussion because it has to do with mathematics, and I am as far from a mathematician as you can get. You and I had a discussion this week about can everything in the universe be defined in terms of math?
And I was wondering, what, and I know there would be an argument about this, but what would be the most complicated mathematical formula out there striving to solve? What problem would it stop, you know, striving to solve? And I'm sure it has to do with astrophysics. But basically, that was the question. If we come down to two or three of the most complicated mathematical formulas, what would be the purpose for staring at those chalkboards that go on forever at an higher learning institution? Go ahead.
Okay, for whatever reason, your signal has degraded from the previous time. You're now about 30% noise. So if there's something you can dangle in the opposite direction or bang on to make it better, please do. And just as an aside, Frank, who's was on Echolink and still is on Echolink, hello, Frank, sent me a text message appropriate to the previous subject. So I just want to tell you, he wrote down that a paper on long-delayed echoes was presented in 2021, and he suggests that it might be available on YouTube. So that's another thing I have to take a look at. Thank you, Frank. As far as your question, Rich, you know, it's up for argument among mathematicians, pseudo-mathematicians, and severe non-mathematicians. Mathematicians are not that interested in benefits to their mathematics. They're more of, as a group, I found personally, into an odd aesthetics of mathematics. They have a different appreciation for math than most of us do. And there is an elegance and a beauty in equations that they are striving for. And as I mentioned to you in a phone conversation, very often important aspects of math that later are incorporated into important concepts in physics start out unattached to any concept in physics whatsoever. It's just an interesting construct that the mathematician goes through to formalize. So, you know, they'll do transforms of coordinate systems for geometric weird reasons, and then Einstein will come and map those transforms onto his theory of special relativity. That's usually how it works. Mathematicians are not practical as a group. They're more into the... Rich, you're now about 80% noise, so maybe you should switch out back to the dummy load or check that your battery is reasonably charged, because I'm concerned that we may lose any second there. Anyway, I'll give Rich a little chance to kind of check on his radio, make sure that nothing has gone kaboom or anything, and just mention to people that, you know, this mathematics is an incredibly wide field, especially theoretical. There are theorems that are unproven, that you can win $1 million if you submit a proof that is accepted by mathematicians. I think a Russian gentleman did one only about 2 or 3 years ago and got his $1 million prize. They're very few and far between. So there are unproven theorems, but that's, to me, not the most complicated. The most complicated and perhaps the most important mathematical equation is the mathematical description. intensity and time and energy and all kinds of fun stuff. It's a very long-winded, very complex, very complicated equation. And almost no one, well, no one has the faintest idea how to solve every part of it. Some components of that larger equation have been solved using mathematical tricks, but others have not. So that's probably the big mathematical equation. Tend to be more interested in aesthetics, so they might be completely disinterested by that and more interested by some esoteric aspect of set theory or some other branch of mathematics. Yes.
Oh, I'm a stupid light. So you can go to over this week. We were talking about gallium, but it first goes classical mechanics for technics. okay, so we have that interesting video. Are you going to say a few words about it? And I wonder what would be the response of the audience about temper class. That's correct.
Okay, there's someone sending a signal. I don't know if it's Rich with a degraded signal. I don't know if it's the gentleman in Connecticut who's talking on another repeater. I don't have the faintest idea, but someone is kind of pulsing noise. So let me drop for a second and see what the background sound like. Okay, for whatever reason, it seems to be quiet. For the rest of the audience, Wesley sent me a YouTube of someone demonstrating a principle of... is cooled very quickly, that has built-in stress points in that it depends upon where you direct the force. Now, anyone who's kind of seen a car accident has kind of seen this in action before laminated glass became big. And the problem is because this glass, tempered glass, is all under stress, there are certain weak points in its structure that can basically turn it to pebble glass. And so the YouTube had a guy go over to the corner of this pane of glass rather than smack dab in the middle and gave it a bang, and that shock wave traveled through the entire... You'll also see that in a very fascinating thing called a Prince Rupert drop. You can YouTube it. There's lovely YouTubes on the subject. Ultimately, what that amounts to is you melt a glob of glass into a pail of water, and it has a big head, and then it narrows down to a tail. It sort of looks like, sort of like a sperm cell. And the point is that the stresses, the internal stresses, produced by quick cooling it in a bath of water, lead to the head to be almost breakproof. You can take a hammer and bang on the head of this Prince Rupert drop, and nothing will happen. But if you go to the other end of the fine thinning tail and just snap the edge, the pressure wave will transmit through the entire thing, Prince Rupert's drop, and turn everything once again into little pebble glass. So we have nothing better to do, and if I have a chance during the SpaceNet report, I will put a link to it. Prince Rupert's drop is a wonderful example of the same principle that causes tempered glass to shatter into 1,000 pieces.
Yeah, I have a few words. Okay, talking about the tempered glass, I was trying to find out the nature of sudden weak point creating to turn into thousands of